Welcome to this edition of the Remembering Rush series of the Law and Liberty podcast of the Chalcedon Foundation. I am your host, Andrea Schwartz, and I have with me today a man who describes himself as a consummate historian and avid bibliophile. In that regard, he's a man very much like Chalcedon's founder, R.J. Rushdooney. Bill Potter has earned a well-deserved reputation as a man gifted in communicating the story of God's providential hand in American history. And today I'm going to find out how Rushdooney ended up being a big influence on his ministry work and his role as a homeschooling father of 8 children. Thanks for joining me, Bill.
Thanks, Andrea.
Is it true that you have a library of over 4,000 antiquated hardback books?
Well, I have a library somewhere between 4,000 and 5,000 books. They're not all antiquated by any means, and I haven't read them all by any means, unlike Rushdooney.
You have them, and you know where they are, and you know where to go when you want to look up something in them. I think he had you beat. I think he had more than 5,000 books. So tell me a little bit about how you first came to know about Rushdooney and the effect that he had on the things that you now spend most of your time doing.
Okay. In 1970, I was a freshman in college, and one of the earliest courses I took, I think it was called political science or social science or something like that. And for my friends and I was the canary in the mine shaft. I took all the stuff that had all the classes that had reputations, and I took them first so I could tell my compatriots whether they ought to take them or not. And one of the classes that I took that first year, the professor was Dr. Alan Monroe. And the first day of class, he held up this big blue book. And he said, class, this is the most important book written in the 20th century. And even as dumb as I was, I thought, well, maybe I ought to read that book. Maybe that's something that would speak to me. It's the most important book written in the 20th century. And I found out that it was a book entitled The Institutes of Biblical Law by Rusas Rushdooney, and that's the first I'd heard of him. I was an 18-year-old freshman in college and all that that implies as far as egg-headedness. And I did acquire a copy of that book, and I read it, and in some very important ways it completely transformed how I thought about scripture and life and history and law. And that's where it began.
So was this a Christian college? Was this a secular college?
No, it's a Christian college, Cedarville. Now it's called Cedarville University. It was Cedarville College when I was there. The history, the philosophy department was Professor James Greer, who had matriculated through Westminster Seminary and was one of Cornelius Van Til's top students. And so being a history major and a philosophy and Bible minor, I took all the philosophy courses from a man who gave us Van Til every day for 4 years.
Wow.
As well as Rushdooney. And I got Rushdooney in the political science class. So right out of the chute at Cedarville, I was introduced to Rushdooney and presuppositional apologetics and all the related and interested fields. And as a history major, I began applying the principles I learned in those philosophy classes to my history learning.
So what was your intent originally when you went to school? Did you decide you were going to be a teacher? Did you want to be a statesman? What were you going for?
Well, my original goal was to teach American history in college, and I had decided on that goal when I was maybe in the seventh grade. I had some good history teachers in school, and it's a long story, but I began studying history kind of seriously in like the third or fourth grade, and by that time I knew I just wanted to do it my whole life, and so I went on from there to get a master's degree and to go on to a doctoral program at the College of William and Mary in Virginia. Through it all, I went to a Marianist university, the University of Dayton, and I went to a secular university, William and Mary, and through it all, I carried all that I had learned from Rush Dooney, and continued to read Rush Dooney through the whole period of my education in applying biblical principles and presuppositional thinking in those schools, and it was not appreciated to a large extent.
Surprise!
So anyway, I was blocked from pursuing that professional academic drudge, and since leaving academia, I've kind of been an independent scholar and a businessman and a variety of other things. And today I teach a lot of history classes, and I speak at state homeschool conventions and colleges, universities, law school. I do lots of things, all related to history in one way or another. I'm the staff historian for the Vision Forum in San Antonio, Texas, and do history tours. And all of it from a, you might say, a Vantillian presuppositional base, mm-hmm. but Rush Dooney really is... was the motivating and informative factor in my life.
You're sort of specializing in military history. I know a lot of the books that you've written have to do with particular battles and particular military men in American history. Why is that a particular favorite of yours?
Well, I became interested in military history very early on, studying my ancestors who fought in the various wars. My dad was in World War II. I've always had a keen interest in military history, and in recent years, I'd say in the last 20 years, I really made a concerted effort to study and communicate military history from a Christian worldview presuppositional perspective, which sometimes is not necessarily easy, and I don't know anyone else who's perhaps pursuing it in the way that I am, but... I really specialized in that over the last 20 years.
What is unique about those I know who have seen you give your lectures and talks? You don't do it in a business suit, do you, all the time?
No, I don't. Not all the time. Sometimes it's in reenactment gear, and sometimes it's on a battlefield. It depends on the venue, as to whether I'm doing a living history type presentation or a scholarly lecture or just an informal time with a bunch of students. And so I do it in different venues and in different ways, and I deal with pretty much a whole range of world military history. And it's kind of a unique niche that I have, and the Lord has used it.
Why do you think it's especially useful for young people to get the visual as opposed to just having a person get up there talking about it? Why do you feel the reenactment gear is something that really helps your story?
Well, especially younger young people, you know, the early teenage years and younger, they really appreciate being able to see history as well as be lectured to, and it adds an kind of an extra dimension for those who are younger. And I think that, you know, definitely if we don't pass on to the next generation a keen appreciation for history and an understanding of the importance of God's providence in every area of our past and present and future as well, if we don't pass it on, nobody else is going to do it. And the most effective way for some people really is to see visually living history, and I've been able to do that at different times through the years. I'd say probably most of my lecturing has been in conferences and maybe a little more academic type settings, but I tell a lot of stories, so I don't necessarily have to be dressed in costume. I can sometimes send them back in time verbally.
I see. It must have been assigned to you in your homeschooling division of labor that you probably handle the history.
I do. I handle the history and a lot of the reading and literature, but I do all of the history, that's for sure. You know, Rush Dooney certainly played a part in all of that. You know, he said the Bible deals with history. It doesn't rapture us out, but plunges us into it. And, you know, I've never forgotten those words. And I have, sort of keenly pursued the idea of history as the outworking of God's providence in time and space. And, you know, the biblical philosophy of history that Rush Dooney wrote, I use that in a number of very important papers that I wrote in academia. Again, not highly appreciated sometimes.
Right. Did you ever get a chance to meet Rush in person?
I did. Right out of college, my wife and I were teaching in a Christian school in Cleveland, Ohio, and they really wanted her. they made room for me. And so I ended up teaching American history and world history and, I don't know, six or seven other things for $6,000 a year. But while at that school, which, by the way, was Arminian and dispensationalist to the absolute core, and I was a, you know, I was a square peg at that place. But the attorney for the school, in a conversation with me one day, said, "We're trying to find a speaker for our state, it was called ACSI or something like that, CSI convention, Christian schools, whatever." And I said, "Have you ever heard of Rusash Rush Dooney?" And he said, "No, I never have." And I said, "I think that if you would read a little of Rush Dooney, you might find your speaker." And so he said, "Well, do you have any of his books?" And I probably had, I don't know, 8, 9, 10 books. I got the Journal of Christian Reconstruction. I listened to the tapes, everything. So what I did is I brought him The Messianic Character of American Education and handed that to him. The next day, he brought it back to me. And he said, "You got any more?"
Wow.
Read all the way through it. And I said, "Well, yes, I have some more." And I brought him The Institutes of Biblical Law. I thought, you know, throw him in the deep end right away.
Right.
He read that. A couple days later, he comes back to me and he says, "Mr. Rush Dooney's consented to being the keynote speaker at our annual conference. Would you like to chauffeur him around for a week?"
And I twist your arm.
I said, "Let me check my social schedule. I think we can work that in." And so my wife and I got to drive him around for, I think it was 4 days, something like that, of this convention, which was held in Ashland, Ohio. And it was one of the highlights of my life. I was, 22 years old, fresh out of college, and really gung-ho on applying all that I'd learned to history and the teaching, and here I got to spend 4 days with Dr. Rush Dooney, taking him to dinner, picking him up at the hotel, all the things that you do when you are the chauffeur for an important speaker, and it was a marvelous opportunity. And I might add, too, that the audience was 99.99% Arminian and dispensational. But they were Christian school people and Christian educators, and they were really hungry for the truth, and he gave it to them by the shovelful. And he didn't have to use, he didn't use the word that would have terrorized them and sent them screaming out the back of the church, Calvinism. He didn't use the terminology that we would use in that kind of a setting or conversation normally. He just told them the truth regarding education and a Christian philosophy of education. And standing ovation after standing ovation, and he was giving them raw Calvinism and the application of the sovereignty of God and biblical truth to every academic discipline. It was a brilliant performance, and they had never heard anything like it, and it was like starving people being fed for the first time. It was a wonder to behold.
I hope you got a raise.
I got kicked out the next year, and by the time I was thrown out, I guess I'd subverted the faculty. 11 faculty went when we did, but it was really too late. Anyway.
The influence had been peddled, yes. So was that the extent of it? Did you stay in touch with him over the years? Did you have occasions to ever speak at the same conferences or things like that?
No, we never did. That's the only time I got to meet him. I had, at the end of the conference, I gave him a 200-year-old edition of Isaac Watts' hymns. and he sent me a copy of the children's book published by Chalcedon, and signed it. And that's really the last, you know, personal contact I had with him. I was just a newly minted high school teacher going back to graduate school, and we did not maintain contact other than the fact that I followed him through the tape, you know, the tape ministry and everything that was published.
Right. You said something earlier that caught my interest, having been a homeschool mom myself, although all three of my children are past the homeschool age. You talked about being in third grade age level and really having this desire and this calling. Most people would comment and say, what does a third grader know? I mean, yeah, sure, he might have liked a story here or there. Can you speak to the idea of helping to unearth the callings that God has placed in our children's lives?
Well, I can sort of give my own testimony to that. And I firmly believe what I said earlier about that. And it really has to do with our family life. For 1 year, we had to live with my grandparents while my dad built our new house. And my grandfather had a big drawer full of pictures. And it turned out that we had a person in our family who was a photographer in the 1850s when it first began and continued taking pictures up to the 20th century. And we have images of everybody in our family back that far. And I was fascinated with the different clothing and the houses and the horses and the wagons and the fact that they were related to me. And I asked my grandfather to tell me stories about our family. And he did. I did have a sort of a vague understanding of the past and of, I wouldn't have known to call it history or anything like that, but these were people that lived long ago. Long before my time, and I was related to them, and I wanted to know about them, and it piqued my interest. So one of the ways in which, because that was effective with certainly with me, and when I began going to, you know, I went to government school my whole life, but I had, you know, I took history classes and so-called social studies and all of that, and I always had a keen interest, and it had really been piqued originally by my grandfather and my father telling me family stories. And that is one way to get children really interested in learning history, is to tell them family stories that they can actually identify with. It happened with me at just the earliest age that I could comprehend that sort of stuff. And given the fact that I was raised in a Christian home and the Bible was ever present, it was just omnipresent all around me, and you know, I was from the day I was born, I was hearing the Word of God and learning the Bible stories, learning Scripture. And I didn't start putting those things together until I was probably in high school, and then in college it bloomed. But the interest really came with family stories that I could identify with at a very early age. And eventually it became, you know, part of my calling. In fact, it became my calling. To teach the mighty acts of God on a full-time, regular basis.
And I think the important aspect there is you grew up in a culture that honored and revered God's word. And so even though, you know, you probably look back and say it probably would have been better if I hadn't gone to government schools, because you certainly didn't choose that route for your own children, there's a sense of the fact that God preserved that that desire in your heart and didn't let it get squashed by a lot of bad secular history along the way.
Yep, that is true. And, you know, we were in a church that my parents were instrumental in founding, and my grandparents were devout Christians, as were all my aunts and uncles, all my first cousins, all of their children are believers, and down through the generations, God's covenant faithfulness has been most evident in the family that I was born into and raised in, and all of that helped nurture my appreciation for God's providence and for His loving concern for His people down through the ages, and that was able to, you know, because of that, I was I was not buffaloed by the kind of history that I had good history teachers, but I was able to put it in the right context because of my biblical foundations.
Is there any recommendation you would make to homeschooling parents in terms of how to present, I mean, you've already mentioned how to present your own family history, but how not to make it a dry subject so that the kids say, oh, I hate history?
Well, one thing is really to emphasize and deal with people of history. You know, people are fascinating, and as Noah Webster said, that you know, one of the first words that a child should be able to lisp is the name of Washington, the name of George Washington, and you know, with understanding that you know, here was the one of the great founders of our country, a great military general, a man of genius in many ways, and learn the stories of people of the past. I think that's really important. And when you can do it in a visual context, like, you know, we lived in Williamsburg, Virginia for 28 years. We were surrounded with living history, and I'm a Civil War reenactor, and we went out reenacting as a family. We spent, you know, maybe 3 or 4 times a year. We'd go to a Civil War battle reenactment, but we would camp as a family. Everybody would dress up, and we just had a tremendous cooking over the fire and doing all the things that our ancestors did. And we were there really to honor their sacrifice, and that spoke volumes to my children. Of course, I shouldn't be surprised about this, but one of the ironies in my own personal family is that right now, at this very moment, I have a son who's in Iraq. He's in the 29th Infantry Division, which is the Virginia National Guard, and that was a D-Day unit at Omaha Beach. I have another son who's in the 82nd Airborne. He's 20 years old, and he's at Georgia Military School right now, but he's in the Georgia National Guard, just assigned to the 82nd Airborne that dropped on D-Day. And then I have a son-in-law who's an Army Ranger stationed at Fort Benning, and another son-in-law who's a captain in the 101st Airborne. So I have four boys in my family that are in D-Day units, modern version of them. I probably shouldn't be surprised.
No, I don't think many people would be surprised considering how they were raised. Supposing, let's say somebody couldn't make it to the various conferences or conventions that you speak at, do you have a series of your lectures, especially the ones where you dress up, on DVD that's available for people to purchase?
I do not. I've never done that for reproduction purposes. As far as my lectures go, and some of them have proven to be fairly popular among homeschoolers, are available through the Vision Forum. I have 4 different lecture series on various aspects of military history. And
excellent. Okay.
I also have other lectures and related things that I've done on American history, sort of a broader perspective on other topics and people and that sort of thing. And I'm in the process of establishing a website where those will be available too. But I don't have any of the actual videos. However, there is someone who has done that. It's called Soldiering Through History.
Okay.
And it's a family of boys, homeschool boys from Maine, by the name of McIntyre, and they've done World War II, and I think maybe French and Indian War, and War for American Independence, and these videos are just terrific. They show children how they can teach boys of all ages how to learn about military history in their backyard. That's what it says on the back of it.
Okay,
really
good. Soldiering Through History. I'll put that up on the website so that people can see it as well. Any places that you know you're going to be in the next 6 months or so that people might maybe decide to put a family vacation together and see Bill Potter?
Well, I do battlefield tours and Civil War sesquicentennial tours, but I'm usually only scheduled out maybe 2 months ahead of time. My next one's going to be at the Chickamauga Battlefield in Georgia. Anybody can reach me at bpotter@theamericanhistoryguild.com. That's theamericanhistoryguild.com. And send me an email, and I will put them on my mailing list, and every activity that I'm involved in that's a public, that's open to the public, or that I'm sponsoring, they will get a tickler in the mail describing what we're doing. But if someone would send me an email, I'd be happy to put them on the mailing list and alert them to events that I'm doing in different parts of the country.
Excellent. Okay, well, we're almost out of time here. I've asked other people this, but you're a good person to ask. Other than the books you have mentioned, the Institutes of Biblical Law and the Biblical Philosophy of History, what's one of your favorite Rush Dooney books?
If someone's just inquiring about Rush Dooney and they say, what should I read first? I think Law and Liberty is a good beginning book. And I really like, you know, Politics of Guilt and Pity, because the thing about Rush Dooney's writing is that it's all timely. Nothing has changed since he wrote some of these things in the 60s and 70s. The things that he, you know, has written on politics and law and culture, it's like he wrote it yesterday. So, you know, I think Law and Liberty is a good place to start. The Messianic Character of American Education, if somebody, it's still a very timely book because it goes into the roots of our educational system. And if someone reads, a Christian reads that honestly, they're going to have a very difficult time keeping their children in the government schools knowing what they now know. So those are some I certainly would recommend.
Well, excellent. Well, thank you. I really appreciate the time, and I hope that people will make use of the resources that you've mentioned, and I wish you the best. I'll have to catch you someday at a conference. I love it when people dress up, and it gives me a sense of being there, so I guess I'm still a kid at heart.
Well, thank you, Andrea. So am I.
Listeners, thank you so much for joining me today, and check out the books that Bill recommended, and you can find them at www.calcedonstore.com. Join me again next time for another edition of the Law and Liberty Podcast.